We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. Well, here he is, a wizard of wiz, if ever a wiz there was. If ever, oh, ever a wiz there was, the Wizard of Oz has won. Because of the wonderful things he does. We're off to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
This is The Wizards of Money, your money and financial management series, but with a twist. My name is Smithy, and I'm a wizard watcher in the land of Oz. In this, the 11th edition of The Wizards of Money, we're going to take a look at the wild and crazy world of financial derivatives, through examining the role and dangers of leverage in our modern society. Our adventure will end with a story called Because a Little Bug with the Asian Flu Went Ka-Choo. You might have heard a similar story when you were a child, but in this case, the star of our story is the Long-Term Capital Management Fund, or LTCM. LTCM was an unregulated hedge fund addicted to risk and high on derivatives that could have sent us crashing into the next Great Depression in 1998, but for the intervention of the Federal Reserve. The quiet rescue of LTCM by our federally insured banks, combined with the fact that LTCM was a private equity fund and hence shielded from public scrutiny, aided in this potential catastrophe being confined to a discussion among only the financial elite. That we came very close to a global financial collapse went almost unnoticed by the general public. The ability to sweep this embarrassing incident, revealing the true nature of risks emanating from the derivatives casino, under the rug, thus prevented the regulatory spotlight from being shone on either the casino or its most secretive dealers, the private, unregulated hedge funds. The keeping of the derivatives wizards behind the curtain has enabled them to come up with newer and potentially deadlier games. The newest game on the block is called the Credit Default Swap, and even the International Monetary Fund is getting worried about this one. But before we step into discussion of derivatives and leverage, let's discuss what is known as the house edge. Imagine you are stepping into a casino in Vegas, and imagine what you will see. In one section, you will walk past the slot machines, and nearby will likely be the keno room with a comfy chairs and table for all your free drinks. In a separate section of the casino, there will be games that are more complex and harder to play, such as blackjack, craps, and the like. Secured away upstairs or in some guarded area are the rooms for the high rollers. Now, think of the socio-economic classes you are likely to find in each area. In general, you'll find the lower income people will be at the slot machines and in the keno room, and the highest income people will, of course, be in the high rollers room. In the middle are those at the regular blackjack and craps tables. Now ask yourself, given this distribution of class by game, which group has the worst odds? Which group is likely to lose the most of what they wager? The answer? The keno players and the slot machine players. And not just by a small amount either, but by a very large amount as evidenced by statistics reflected in what is known as the house edge. I'm sure you might be surprised by the differentials if you haven't seen these before. The house edge is defined as the average amount that a player will lose as a percentage of their initial bet in any game. This average is always positive by necessity, so that the house can make a profit and thereby stay in business, or in other words, avoid collapsing. The house edge or margin on an average bet is positive, and the rest of the money wagered is simply redistributed amongst the casino players, and that is what gambling is all about. Those players that lose are simply passing on their funds to those that win. That the house edge is positive simply means that on the whole, the losers lose more than the winners win, and the house takes the difference for its efforts in arranging the distribution of wages. Without the house to provide this function, there would be no such gambling on such a large scale. I got some data on the House Edge from the website of a professional gambling analyst. The website is called thewizardofodds.com and it's no relation to the Wizards of Money. I recommend you look at this data on the Wizard of Odds website if you are interested in the most probable amount of money you are going to lose if you hang out at the casino too long. Here's the House Edge data. Keno has the very worst odds with a house edge of a whopping 25 to 30%. This means the following. Let's suppose you go to the casino one night with 1,000 of your closest friends for statistical significance, and you all play Keno all night at a place where the house edge is 25%. As a group, you will walk out of the casino with 25% less than what you came in with. Some of your friends are going to lose everything, while others may double or even triple their money, but on the whole, the group has lost a quarter of what it started with. You and your 1,000 friends have simply redistributed money between yourselves and paid the house a whopping premium for the privilege of doing it on their premises with all of the wizardry that masks what is really going on. Slot machines are next. You will lose on average between 5 and 15% of what you put into a slot machine, depending on the casino and the type of machine. Craps comes third, where you will lose on average between 1 and 15% depending on how you play the game. Your best bet, however, is blackjack, as long as you know how to play, with a house edge of less than 0.5%. The very best bets or best odds will often be found, of course, in the high rollers room, where the house knows it has a smaller edge on a much larger base. In a spooky kind of way, the social and economic relations of the seedy casino world mimic relations between humans and the financial markets in the broader world. Consider the house in the broader world to be the financial markets themselves, backed up by banks and central banks who create the most basic forms of money. Consider that for any attempt to generate returns, a piece of your effort is going off to the financial markets or the house in order to keep it going. Consider that the wealthier you are to begin with, the higher are your chances of winning more money, and the more money you have, the better the house treats you and the better the terms of credit should you wish to borrow from the house. Consider that the poorer you are, the more expensive it is to play and the chances of positive returns are much lower. But the real world situation gets worse. Now consider that the dealers are incented to win for the house by participating in the gambles themselves. If the dealers want to borrow from the house to play, that's quite okay. They will get good terms of credit. If they lose too much, they get fired, and you only keep the dealers that keep winning. To attract the very best dealers, you decide not to regulate them, and so you don't keep track of what their betting positions are, or even how much they borrowed from the house. Well, they are smart people, the best dealers. Some of them even came up with computer programs to predict the unpredictable, and that is how pure chance gambles will come out. So, of course, you don't need to regulate them. But then, one day, the smartest and most winningest dealer of all, a private equity fund, loses a huge gamble, most of the wager having been borrowed from the house. There's no way he can repay this loan to the house, and the house looks like it's going to go bankrupt. But the house can't fail, or the whole system collapses. In order to avoid the casino collapsing, the law of the land says that the casino players, plus all of those that have never even been to the casino in their lives, must be charged a certain amount to avoid the collapse of the casino. Now that's what I call a house edge. Now we're going to move on to talk about leverage. We all have a basic idea of what a lever is and what leverage is in the physical world. Generally, people will conjure up an image of leverage as being the ability to input a small amount of force or energy of your own and get a much larger result at the other end. The amplification of a small amount of input to give a much larger output is facilitated by a lever. One of the first levers we come across as a child is the seesaw, where you're able to lift a person about 3 feet or so off the ground, a feat you'd never achieve if you tried to lift them with your own arms. The seesaw can bring with it great fun and a great return on your investment in a visit to the park. But if it broke while you were playing on it, both you and your seesaw partner would be in a much worse position than if you'd simply dropped the other person while trying to lift them directly without leverage. So too with any kind of leverage. Leverage can bring great benefits and higher expected returns on any effort, but like anything that can increase your returns, it also increases your risk. A sudden switch in the wrong direction of a highly leveraged system, by virtue of the fact that leverage multiplies the force of any input, can bring disastrous consequences way beyond those possible in a less leveraged system. The modern financial system is built entirely on leverage. The financial equivalent of physical leverage is the use of debt or borrowed money to enhance returns. The whole monetary system has been built on leverage ever since the invention of fractional reserve banking in the 1700s, where banks expanded the money supply by continuously lending out deposits backed by a much smaller reserve of real physical assets, such as gold. But if there was ever a loss of confidence in the banks, a run on banks would collapse the whole banking system, thereby rendering money worthless. The collapse of the medium of exchange would then grind all trade to a halt, plunging people into immediate poverty and massively increasing all social tensions. Such a dramatic collapse of trade caused by monetary collapse would not be possible without such leverage. Today's banking works a bit differently than the old system of the 1700s. Though we still have fractional reserve banking, the amount of leverage in the banking system is really driven by what is known as capital requirements. And we spoke about these capital requirements and what they are in Wizards Part 2 on financial risk transfer. In Wizards Part 2, we spoke about the capital requirements that are being set under the new Basel Capital Accords being set by a committee at the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. Let us suppose you have $100 to invest by either depositing your money in a bank as a bank depositor or becoming a bank shareholder. If you just become a bank depositor, you can earn 5% a year on your $100 deposit. But if you become a bank shareholder, you get to borrow additional money from the depositors of the bank and lend this money out at a higher rate, keeping the difference in interest rates for your own profit. Let's suppose that for every $100 of shareholder or equity capital a bank has, it can borrow $900 from its depositors, loan out the total $1,000 at a 7% interest rate. Then your profit as a shareholder is calculated as follows. First of all, on the income side, you've got $1,000 times 7% interest, which is $70 of income from people that borrow from the bank. Your profit will be calculated by taking this number minus the outgo, which is 5% on $900 of deposits, which is $45 to go back to the depositors whose money you borrowed to make your loans. That leaves you with a clear $25 of profit on your $100 investment, which is a 25% return on investment. That's much better than the $5 or 5% you would get as just a depositor of the bank. And the reason is, quite simply, leverage. As a bank owner, you could basically borrow 9 times your own capital investment to make a much larger return than you could have done with just your own money. We say that you, or actually the bank's leverage, was 9, which is the ratio of debt to equity in the bank's total investments. But such leverage comes with many more risks than if you just invested your own $100. One obvious risk is that some of the $1,000 borrowed from the bank will not be paid back. If this amount is less than $100 plus any interest profits you or the bank makes, then the loss simply hits your investment, but the bank still has enough money to pay back the depositors. But what happens if $100 or more of the $1,000 of bank loans don't get paid back? Then the bank will be insolvent or bankrupt, and some of the bank depositors will have lost their money. Well, unless there is a government bailout, that is. This is just the type of loss that can trigger a further series of loan defaults and thereby start a chain reaction of defaults, asset sales, lost confidence, and mad panic that can lead to a financial collapse. It is clear that the higher the leverage or multiple of your own investment you can borrow from depositors to lend out, then the higher your potential returns, but also the higher the risk of potential catastrophe. For example, if the bank's leverage was now 19 instead of 9, they could borrow $1,900 from depositors added to your $100 investment in shareholder equity. This huge leverage could bring a 45% return if nobody defaults on their bank loans and interest rates stay the same. But the risk of losing $100 in the larger pool of bank loans is now much greater, and it's this loss that can cause bank collapse. Financial leverage lies at the heart of the development of modern societies. It is the great facilitator of our massive production and distribution of energy and goods and our rapid technological advancement. Without such leverage, there would not have been enough money to fuel the Industrial Revolution or the Technological Revolution as they've happened. Without the confidence in this highly leveraged system, you would not have the cooperation between people to get such big projects completed. Many people in the developed world would not want to give up their modern luxuries, nor, in fact, could many even survive now without many of them. But this exposes another danger of financial leverage, that this leverage has led the developed world into complete dependence on physical leverage created through financial leverage. In our high-tech world, we are used to easy access to massive physical energies, such as food, electricity, transportation, and so forth, for very little effort of our own. Not only does the increased financial leverage increase the risk of a breakdown in the system of trade, but a history of dependence on the physical leverage brought about by financial leverage could multiply the physical consequences of a financial collapse many times over. One feature of today's financial markets, now that we are more than a generation away from the Great Depression of the 1930s, is that the thrill of returns from leverage and the excitement of greater technological advancement mask the reality of the risks imposed by leverage. We have gone so long without a collapse, indeed partly due to various innovations that have helped to put out fires that could have caused a collapse, that potential and systemic risks do not get the attention they deserve. We know the banks are pretty highly leveraged and that these risks of leverage must be controlled since the banks lie at the heart of the financial system. The way this leverage is controlled so that the risk of collapse is not too high is to set limits on leverage commensurate with the risk of any loans or investments any bank is making. This is what the new Basel Capital Accord being discussed now at the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, which is the central bank of central bankers, is all about. These accords specify a certain amount of equity or shareholder capital, or you can think of it as a safety net that banks hold as a function of the riskiness of their loans or investments. Such a safety net sets a bound on leverage and provides protection for depositors and taxpayers who are ultimately on the hook for massive bank failure. But under the current adrenaline-fed mindset of the capital markets, even these controls are continuously circumvented. Like I said earlier, one of the newest kids on the block is the credit default swap or credit derivatives, and they are being used to get around these safety nets or caps on leverage. A derivative on an underlying asset basically allows you to make a bet on the future price of that underlying asset by betting just a fraction of the cost of that asset. The leverage comes about because the instrument basically replicates borrowing or lending of the underlying asset without you ever having to physically own the asset. Derivatives can help you manage risk if you already trade in the underlying asset. Let's say you're a wheat farmer worried about the price of wheat. Then derivatives can be used to buy insurance on wheat prices. Let's say if wheat prices go down, you can get compensated for your loss by buying insurance in the form of something called a futures contract or even what is known as a put option on wheat. Your outlay for this protection is fixed, the cost of the insurance premium, but it has removed the potentially larger loss of plummeting prices. However, like all such things with a good use, there is a large downside. The downside is that the leverage and potential returns available on derivatives attract speculators from all over the globe to play and to become major dealers at the derivatives casino. This includes what is known as the private equity hedge fund, capitalized by wealthy investors and then often also borrowing many multiples of this capital from federally insured banks. With this highly leveraged capital base, they then enter into the highly leveraged and potentially lucrative world of derivatives gambling. Private hedge funds are not regulated on the grounds that their investors are sophisticated and that regulators don't seem to understand or be worried about the risks that depositors and taxpayers are exposed to by the largest and most highly leveraged of these bodies. In addition, the huge hundreds of trillion size market known as the over-the-counter or OTC derivatives market is not regulated. And of course, our banks themselves are among the major players and dealers at this casino. Consider the young, unregulated credit default swap market, the newest, hottest game on the block. This enables institutions that lend money to high credit risk to buy insurance on those risks. For example, a bank with high loan exposures to certain lenders can pay a premium to a third party for a credit default swap, which is a form of credit insurance, whereby the bank would get reimbursed by the credit swap seller if the borrower defaulted. The bank is thus able to take this credit risk off of its balance sheet and thereby is no longer required to hold the regulated amount of equity capital or safety net against this risky credit risk. This means, of course, that the bank can further increase its leverage. If the seller of the credit swap is not a bank, and especially if it is one of the unregulated private hedge funds, then there may be no capital requirements i.e. safety nets or leverage limits, on such credit. Therefore, through the use of credit default swaps, the overall financial system safety net shrinks and leverage and associated risks of collapse are increased. As always, to be borne by depositors and taxpayers if things get too out of hand. Add to this the fact that banks and others in need of credit protection are entering into these swaps through the now famous off-balance sheet special purpose vehicles to remove the underlying transactions from public and regulator scrutiny. So it's very difficult to tell what's going on and where and what the real risks are. Now let's hear from the great wizard Greenspan of the US Federal Reserve on these issues from a March 7, 2002 report to the Senate Banking Committee. He talks first about the risk of the US economy becoming increasingly dependent on abstract concepts rather than on the production of real goods and services. And then he talks about the risk-return trade-off of derivatives and leverage.
However, the very technologies that appear to be the main cause of our apparent increased flexibility and resiliency may also be imparting different forms of vulnerability that could intensify or be intensified by a business cycle. From one perspective, the ever-increasing proportion of our GDP that represents conceptual as distinct from physical value added may actually have lessened cyclical volatility. In particular, the fact that concepts cannot be held as inventories means a greater share of GDP is not subject to the type of dynamics that amplifies cyclical swings. But an economy in which concepts form an important share of valuation has its own vulnerabilities. As the recent events surrounding Enron have highlighted, a firm is inherently fragile if its value added emanates more from conceptual as distinct than physical assets. A physical asset, whether an office building or an automotive assembly plant, has the capability of producing goods or services, even if the reputation of the managers of such facilities falls under a cloud. The rapidity of Enron's decline is an effective illustration of the vulnerability of a firm whose market value largely rests on capitalized reputation. The physical assets of such a firm comprise a small proportion of its asset base. Trust and reputation can vanish overnight. A factory cannot. The implications of such a loss of confidence for the macroeconomy depend importantly on how freely the conceptual capital of a fading firm can be replaced by a competitor or a new entrant into the industry. Even if entry is relatively free, macroeconomic risks can emerge if problems at one particular firm tend to make investors and counterparties uncertain about other firms that they see as potentially similarly situated. The difficulty of valuing firms that deal primarily with concepts and the growing size and importance of these firms may make our economy more susceptible to this type of contagion. Another more conventional determinant of stability will be the economy's degree of leverage, the extent to which debt rather than equity is financing the level of capital. A sophisticated financial system with its substantial array of instruments to unbundle risks will tend toward a higher degree of leverage at any given level of underlying economic risk. The greater the degree of leverage in any economy, the greater its vulnerability to unexpected shortfalls in demand and mistakes. Although the fears of business leverage have been mostly confined to specific sectors in recent years, concerns over potential systemic problems resulting from the vast expansion of derivatives have emerged with the difficulties of Enron. To be sure, firms like Enron and long-term capital management before it were major players in the derivatives markets. But their problems were readily traceable to an old-fashioned excess of debt however acquired, as well as to opaque accounting of that leverage and lax counterparty scrutiny. Swaps and other derivatives throughout their short history, including over the past 18 months, have been remarkably free of default. Of course, there can be latent problems in any market that expands as rapidly as these markets have. Regulators and supervisors are particularly sensitive to this possibility. Derivatives have provided greater flexibility to our financial system, but their very complexity could leave counterparties vulnerable to significant risk that they do not currently recognize, and hence these instruments potentially expose the overall system if mistakes are large.
While Wizard Greenspan gives a good picture of the uncertainty of the risks of massive leverage, he is also, on balance, in favour of it and the continued lax regulation of both hedge funds and OTC, or over-the-counter derivatives markets. He argues that derivatives play an important role of distributing risk efficiently, and this helps build resilience into the markets against shocks. While that might be true, he forgets that some shocks just cannot be swallowed by the market, and the implications for the market are catastrophic due to the size of the underlying leverage involved. How he could forget this, I just don't know. For one such incident took place just 4 years earlier, with the near collapse of the huge private long-term capital management fund, or LTCM. And we're going to talk about the LTCM saga now. That people do not understand the risks exposed by the LTCM saga is evidenced by the much greater attention given to a recently collapsed derivatives player who did not pose even a sliver of the threat to the financial system that LTCM did. That recently collapsed player being, of course, Enron. Long-term capital management, or LTCM, was not allowed to collapse because this could have triggered a major global financial collapse. The reason Enron was allowed to collapse was because their collapse posed no such threat. Since LTCM didn't collapse because it wasn't allowed to, the lack of awareness of the risks exposed by it resulted in there being nothing done to prevent another LTCM-type calamity. LTCM was started by four smarty pants wizards with an amazing betting program that did the impossible. It predicted the outcome of derivatives gambles. Two of the wizards had even won a Nobel Prize for their derivatives pricing theories that were widely used to price transactions. Needless to say, the street thought they were geniuses, and this gave their hedge fund easy access to credit and the ability to borrow at rates of a much less risky operation. Respectable banks and investors across the country wanted in on this action that had returned stellar amounts in its first few years of operation. To this day, the fancy bank capital requirements coming out of the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland still do not address the risks of lending to these unregulated hedge funds, so the banks were, and still are, feeding at the trough of all this gambling madness. By mid-1998, LTCM had about $4 billion in equity capital and borrowed funds of around $120 billion, a hefty leverage of about 30 times. But amazingly, that leverage was compounded further by another tenfold by LTCM's off-balance sheet derivatives exposures, whose notional principal amounted to more than another $1 trillion. To be clear, this notional principal does not represent the full amount owed to anyone, but rather the full value of assets underlying various derivatives transactions. The biggest bet that LTCM had on its books in the summer of 1998 was to do with interest rates on underlying bonds, predicting that the difference between interest rates on risky bonds and interest rates on the safest of all bonds, US Treasury securities, would go down in the near future. But in August 1998, Russia unexpectedly defaulted on its domestic debt, causing the market to panic, sell off risky assets, and rush into the safest investment, US Treasuries. This pushed up the price of US Treasuries and pushed down the price of riskier bonds, which is the same as saying that interest rates on US Treasuries went down while rates on riskier bonds went up. That is, the spread between risky bonds and US Treasuries widened, which is exactly the opposite of the LTCM bets. When you trade in derivatives and gamble that the price or rate on an underlying asset will move in a certain direction, you are said to be in the money when the price of that asset is in line with the direction of your bet. You are out of the money when the price moves against the direction of your bet. Counterparties see how much they are in or out of the money by marking their positions to market on a regular basis. If you are out of the money, your betting counterparty to your derivatives transaction or your derivatives clearing agent will call on you to deposit some type of collateral with them in line with the amount your bet is wrong or out of the money. This deposit serves as security towards you being able to settle the full transaction on the agreed upon date in the derivatives trade. When the real world went in the opposite direction to the massive LTCM bets, LTCM counterparties were getting worried about their money from LTCM, especially since LTCM was so highly leveraged. LTCM might have been forced to liquidate its assets in a fire sale in order to meet margin calls triggered by their sudden slide out of the money. Either they would have to sell off a massive amount of assets quickly to meet these large calls, or if they couldn't do this, they would default. Either way, a chain reaction of panic would ripple through the markets. Soon after the Russian default, it became clear that LTCM's positions were such that it had now lost most of its equity capital in just a few days. Not only were its bank loans now at risk, but if LTCM defaulted on meeting its margin requirements with derivatives counterparties, all counterparties would have immediate claims on LTCM, and its many derivatives positions would be shut down. This would have sent a wave of panic through the derivatives markets because LTCM was such a big player, and this would probably bleed into most other financial markets. If LTCM had to liquidate its assets in a fire sale to meet margin calls and satisfy its counterparties, then because of the size of the assets that needed to be sold, this massive sell-off would have depressed prices and caused panic, pushing asset prices down even further. In turn, this would have hampered LTCM's ability to meet margin requirements, as well as its ability to repay the banks they borrowed their gambling funds from. Compounding these problems was the realization that many market players, including major banks and securities firms, made copycat bets and their positions would be further harmed by an LTCM fire sale. Federal Reserve Bank of New York intervened and called together a consortium of banks who were complicit in this hedge fund madness by both lending to LTCM for their gambling needs and by being major players in the unregulated over-the-counter or OTC derivatives markets themselves. It was decided that the bank consortium would lend more money to LTCM by lending them the funds necessary to meet margin calls and prevent the massive panic that default and/or massive asset sales would have caused. The thinking was that these loans would tide over LTCM until its betting positions turned around so that the banks were thereby also participating in the gambles. And therefore, unbeknown to all of us, the public was also participating in the gamble. Who knows what would have happened if the betting positions continued to get worse? The banks, and therefore their depositors, would have been more and more on the hook for the LTCM gambles. But as things turned out, LTCM gradually came back into the black, and through the combined management of LTCM and the bankers, the LTCM gambles were eventually wound down in an orderly fashion and a financial catastrophe averted. Interestingly, the LTCM founders and some of its investors and creditors blame the whole thing on a distorted market. Apparently their gambling was perfect except for these external forces. Even more interesting is the fact that the general public to this day still has no idea how close their lives came to changing drastically overnight in September of 1998, thanks to the extreme leverage of four smarty pants wizards with easy access to credit. No safeguards were ever put in place to prevent future such incidents. Shall we be content to leave it up to the markets and the bank regulators to continue with the adrenaline-driven speculation as is and then put out fires as needed? Of course, there is no guarantee that their attempts to put out such leverage-induced fires will always work. Indeed, in the case of the LTCM saga, if the bets didn't change direction for an extended period, our lives may well be very different today. We were, as gambling goes, just plain lucky that it didn't get worse. The real problems do not lie in external distortions that mess up bets. They lie in the overconfident betting culture that, on the one hand, has brought great prosperity to a small proportion of the world's people. But the danger lies in the inability to appreciate the balancing dark side of all this prosperity for the few. The dark side includes the lack of prosperity for the many upon which such levers are often built. But it also includes the huge devastation that would result from the collapse of high financial and physical leverage that we, on the prosperous side of the fence, are now completely dependent on. No discussion of financial leverage would be complete without appreciation of the fact that human financial and physical leverage has another dark side, and that is its effect on the non-humans and the natural ecosystems that support us. Always remember that the leverage that supports us and benefits us can be turned against us with just a small amount of force amplified many times by our own systems of leverage. All it requires is a small trigger in the wrong direction, which may flip another switch in the wrong direction, and before long, this turn in an undesirable direction is multiplied by our massive human-created leverage. With that, we go out with a fictional story based on one you might recall from your childhood entitled Because a Little Bug Went Kachoo. I consider this book, from the Cat in the Hat books, to be chaos theory for kids. This story is called Because a Little Bug with the Asian Flu Went Kachoo. Chapter 1 is called The Origins of a Financial Crisis. You may not believe it, but here's how it happened. One fine summer morning in rural Asia, a little bug with the Asian flu sneezed. Because of that sneeze, a little seed dropped. Because that seed dropped, a worm got hit. Because he got hit, the worm got mad. Because he got mad, the worm kicked a tree. Because of that kick, a nut dropped off the tree. Because that nut dropped, a turtle got bopped. Because he got bopped, that turtle named Jake fell on his back with a splash in the lake. Because of that splash, a hen got wet. Because she got wet, that hen got mad. Because she got mad, the hen kicked a bucket. Because of that kick, the bucket went up. Because it went up, the bucket went down. Because it came down, it hit Farmer Brown. And that bucket got stuck on his head. Farmer Brown happened to be the president of the Regional Farmers Association. Just before the bucket landed on his head, he was on the phone to his banker, trying to sort out repayment terms for his fellow farmers, since the weather had been unkind to the crop yields that year. But the bucket slamming onto the farmer's head disconnected the telephone and made it impossible for the banker to call back. The farmer's wife was out gathering up the neighbouring farmers to help remove the bucket from her husband's head, so that the banker couldn't call them either. The banker immediately jumped to the conclusion that the farmers were all going to default on their loans. Word spread quickly throughout the banking industry, and pretty soon the international speculators caught wind of this and started selling off their Asian currencies and investments for fear that a banking crisis was looming. The selling off of Asian currencies put downward pressure on the values, and soon the Asians had to devalue their currencies. This proved disastrous for the Asian banks, whose assets were mostly in local currencies, but who also had large US dollar denominated debt. Almost immediately, the major banks were near insolvency and a run on banks had started. The expectation of the international speculators of a banking crisis was a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Asian crisis then spilled over to Russia, who was already in a precarious position due to high levels of debt. Before long, the Russian government defaulted on its debt. After this series of events, the international speculative community was in a mad panic and began what is known as a flight to quality, selling down bonds of foreign governments and riskier firms and buying up on the safer US government bonds. This pushed down the prices on foreign bonds and pushed up the prices on US treasuries. This is the same as saying that interest rates on US bonds went down and those on foreign bonds went up. In the financial world, we say that spreads on foreign debt over US treasuries got bigger or widened. Back in the US, if you'd been in the upscale town of Greenwich, Connecticut, you might have been woken by a loud scream upon news of the Russian default. For little did anybody know, the massively leveraged hedge fund known as Long-Term Capital Management Fund, or LTCM, had bet a substantial amount of the world's economy on the future narrowing of interest spreads over US treasuries. But with the Russian default, these spreads just got much, much wider. In contrast to the Enron case, federal regulators and the US Federal Reserve realized that a major financial catastrophe may result from not intervening in the LTCM case. LTCM's collapse would have affected us all and maybe cause a type of collapse that can cause a major depression. In the subsequent months, Wizard Greenspan was called before Congress to discuss the LTCM crisis, why the Federal Reserve had stepped into the supposed free markets, and what should be done to prevent future LTCMs. Perhaps one of the most dangerous outcomes of Wizard Greenspan's testimony was his support for the continued lax regulation of both hedge funds and the derivatives markets. In line with this, no regulation of these instruments was forthcoming. Overall, the wild derivatives markets and hedge fund players got off lightly indeed. More blame was put on external factors than on the dangers of the extreme speculative behavior facilitated by both derivatives and private, unregulated hedge funds. This is chapter 2, called The Extinction of Sneezing Bugs and Hot-Tempered Worms. During the grilling of the chief wizard of the Federal Reserve over the LTCM crisis and the near collapse of the global economy, Congress wanted to know the real cause of the financial crisis. They wanted to know the root causes so they could stop the possibility of any future such crises. Recall that our story started with the sneezing bug that caused a worm to kick a tree, which then triggered a series of events that later ended in financial crisis. Not wanting to blame the crisis on the unchecked gambling of smarty pants wizards, their hedge funds and the derivatives bets for fear that this would be detrimental to the lucrative financial markets, the chief wizard sought to place the blame on just the right external factors. He placed blame squarely on the sneezing bug and hot-tempered worm that had originated the sequence of events that triggered the Russian default, which upset the LTCM bets. He stopped short of putting any blame on humans who are, after all, key market players, and he also didn't want to blame the chicken that kicked the bucket for fear that this could trigger massive short selling on poultry futures at the Chicago Exchange. Bugs and worms, not having been commoditized, securitized, and bundled up into neat financial packages by investment bankers, were safe things to blame. The great wizard then proceeded to imply that eradication of Asian sneezing bugs and worms that were short to temper would be the most effective route to prevention of future financial crises. The leaders of America, known to hang on every word of the great wizard, put the following as the next item on their agenda. Bring resolution of eradication of Asian sneezing bugs and hot-tempered worms to the next UN Security Council meeting. This was done at the next UN Security Council meeting, who passed the resolution without a peep of dissent. The plan for eradication was immediately put into effect. The people of Asia, near and dear to the Asian forest, tried to tell the UN of dire consequences that would come from this eradication. But nobody listened. After all, bugs and worms were responsible for a near global financial collapse. And what could be worse than that? Within a few years, all the sneezing bugs and hot-tempered worms of Asia were gone. The financial markets did tremendously for the major gamblers over the next few decades, and not a single negative incident threatened this blissful state. Everybody assumed that the markets would be just fine now that the troublesome bugs and worms were gone. But within a few years, something funny was happening to the Asian forests. You see, the sneezing of bugs was supposed to make seeds drop off in order to distribute seeds throughout the forest for new growth. And the worms were supposed to be hot-tempered and go around kicking trees to distribute their nuts around the forest floor. In this way, nature had built a system of controlled leverage so that a small force like a sneezing bug or a worm of short temper could push the right levers to keep the forest going. Mother Nature had been observing the whole human financial crisis saga with some amusement, knowing that the relatively young species really had not learnt the art of controlled leverage at all, and that this was their real problem. Eventually, they would either figure it out or wipe themselves out. Either way was quite okay. Without the bug and worm seed distribution mechanisms, the seeds and nuts only fell off when they were dried up and dead. So the forest was essentially fixed, so it couldn't produce more trees and shrubbery. It took about 3 decades before the urban people finally realized the forests were thinning. But by that time, it was too late. The thinning of the forest left them susceptible to pest and disease outbreaks, and pretty soon the forests were collapsing. With forest collapse came major climate changes and water-related disasters of floods and droughts. Financially, these environmental disasters hit the balance sheets of the Japanese insurers, who had insured a good part of Asia's physical and economic infrastructure. The problems of the Japanese insurance companies then bled into the already troubled Japanese banking sector, and soon the whole Japanese investment community was suffering. The Japanese, being the world's largest foreign creditors, then began liquidating their foreign assets to meet cash flow needs at home, and stemming from the Asian forest collapse and related environmental disasters. Included in this sell-off were Japanese holdings of US Treasury securities, which panicked other investors who also started selling off US government bonds and rushing into gold. The safest of the sovereign bonds had now been put into question. This pushed down the price of US government bonds and spiked up the cost of borrowing for the US government. Since US government borrowing is more about funding the military than anything else, the Pentagon was essentially shut out of the credit markets for the first time ever. Unable to raise capital, the Pentagon was unable to pay its bills to its dependent private contractors. This then triggered massive defaults by huge defense companies on both their corporate bond issues and their bank loans. While the great wizards had been claiming that derivatives built more resilience into the market against financial shocks, in this unexpected scenario, derivatives made the problem much, much worse and triggered additional layers of default risk and incredible panic. This panic forced more and more people away from the US dollar and into gold. Gold went from $300 per ounce to $5,000 an ounce almost overnight. The Federal Reserve, who, as we know from Wizards Part 1, just makes money up out of thin air, couldn't do very much about this crisis because the linchpin of its success, the might of the US dollar, was now disappearing before its very eyes. They had to pool their gold resources with the US Treasury. They counted up their ounces and then realized that they only had enough to either keep the Pentagon going or to bail out the now collapsed US banking system, but they couldn't do both. This gave birth to the great squabble between the wizards of the great empire and its warlords that, for all we know, could go on for hundreds of years. Meanwhile, the people got tired of this squabbling and developed a healthy new interest in the important work of worms and bugs. Amazingly enough, the great wizard of the now collapsed central bank was rumoured to have uttered at a recent party that he wished that they had had some ecologists on the Federal Reserve Board before all this trouble started. And that's the end of the story. And that's all for Wizards Part 11. Please note that the Wizards of Money has a website located at wizardsofmoney.org.
If you're able to listen to audio on the web and you'd like to catch up with some of the earlier editions of Wizards of Money, you can reach the Wizards of Money site through the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radio4all.org/unwelcome. That's radioforall.org/unwelcome. We'll conclude the program with an announcement from the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Coalition. This Wednesday from 10 a.m. to 2:30 is the first of two field trips put on by the Forest Service to look at the Finger Lakes National Forest and timber management. This is one of several upcoming events the Forest Service is doing to continue revision of the Land and Resources Management Plan that determines land uses in the forest for the next 15 years. Oil and gas will definitely be one of the issues, but they're starting with timber. Public comment at these events is incredibly important. This is a great chance to get involved with the long-term health of your forest, so please join in. The scheduled events include the Timber Management Field Trip, Wednesday, May 8th. There will be another Timber Management Field Trip on Saturday, June 1st. For both of these trips, meet in the forest at the Teeter Pond parking lot. Both trips will be the same according to the Forest Service, and we'll be looking at the role and desired role of timber management in the Finger Lakes National Forest. On Tuesday, May 14th, there will be a Timber Management Educational Forum. It will be held at the Trumansburg Elementary School Auditorium from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. It will be a panel discussion on the use of timber management in the forest from different points of view. A question and answer period will be included. Also, check out the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress website for updates at www.flfwc.org. Those interested in carpooling from Ithaca can contact Garrett W. Meigs at gwm5@cornell.edu, gwm5@cornell.edu. And there'll be an open house meeting of the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress in the town of Hector at the Fire Hall, Thursday, May 30th, from 6:30 to 8 o'clock p.m. It's a great chance to voice public comment about the land use issues in the Finger Lakes National Forest.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
The Rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shining black bits.
Thank you. happy one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end for my guns and my son.